This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Power of Full Engagement. Managing energy, not time, is the key to high performance and positive energy. By Jim Lohr and Tony Schwartz. Read by the authors Jim Lohr and Tony Schwartz.
Hello, I'm Tony Schwartz, Senior Partner and Principal at LGE Performance Systems. My partner, Jim Lohr, and I have been working in the field of performance psychology and business for over 25 years. Together, we created the Corporate Athlete Training System, grounded in work with some of the world's greatest athletes. In this program, The Power of Full Engagement, we will share with you fundamental insights that are key to enduring high performance, as well as to health, happiness, and life balance.
Hi, I'm Jim Lohr, CEO of LGE Performance Systems. Along with Tony, I will be guiding you through this audio program. As a performance psychologist, I have had the opportunity to work with not only world-class athletes, but also elite law enforcement units, medical personnel, corporate leaders, and other professionals whose performance demands are extraordinary. The Power of Full Engagement lays out the key training principles that we have discovered and provides a step-by-step program that will help you to 1. Mobilize 4 key sources of energy. 2. Balance energy expenditure with intermittent energy renewal. 3. Expand capacity in the same systematic way that elite athletes do. And 4. Create highly specific positive energy management rituals. Above all, this book provides a life-changing roadmap to becoming more fully engaged on and off the job. By full engagement, we mean physically energized, emotionally connected, mentally focused, and spiritually aligned.
We live in digital time. Our rhythms are rushed, rapid-fire, and relentless. Our days carved up into bits and bytes. We celebrate breath rather than depth. Quick reaction more than considered reflection. We skim across the surface, alighting for brief moments at dozens of destinations, but rarely remaining for long at any one. We race through our lives without pausing to consider who we really want to be or where we really want to go. We're wired up, but we're melting down. Most of us are just trying to do the best that we can. When demand exceeds our capacity, we begin to make expedient choices that get us through our days and nights, but take a toll over time. We survive on too little sleep, wolf down fast foods on the run, fuel up with coffee, and cool down with alcohol and sleeping pills. Faced with relentless demands at work, we become short-tempered and easily distracted. We return home from long days at work feeling exhausted, and often experience our families not as a source of joy and renewal, but as one more demand in an already overburdened life. We walk around with day planners and to-do lists, Palm Pilots and Blackberries, instant pagers and pop-up reminders on our computers, all designed to help us manage our time better. We take pride in our ability to multitask, and we wear our willingness to put in long hours as a badge of honor. The term 24/7 describes a world in which work never ends. We use words like obsessed, crazed, and overwhelmed not to describe insanity, but instead to characterize our everyday lives. Feeling forever starved for time, we assume that we have no choice but to cram as much as possible into every day. But managing time efficiently is no guarantee that we will bring sufficient energy to whatever it is we are doing. Consider these scenarios. You attend a 4-hour meeting in which not a single second is wasted, but during the final 2 hours, your energy level drops off precipitously and you struggle to stay focused. You race through a meticulously scheduled 12-hour day, but by midday your energy has turned negative, impatient, edgy, and irritable. You set aside time to be with your children when you get home at the end of the day, but you are so distracted by thoughts about work that you never really give them your full attention. You remember your spouse's birthday, your computer alerts you, and so does your Palm Pilot. But by the evening, you're too tired to go out and celebrate. The conclusion? Energy, not time, is the fundamental currency of high performance. This insight has revolutionized our thinking about what drives enduring high performance. It has also prompted dramatic transformations in the way that our clients manage their lives, personally and professionally. Everything they do, from interacting with colleagues and making important decisions to spending time with their families, requires energy. Obvious as this seems, we often fail to take into account the importance of energy at work and in our personal lives. Without the right quantity, quality, focus, and force of energy, we are compromised in any activity we undertake. Every one of our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors has an energy consequence, for better or for worse. The ultimate measure of our lives is not how much time we spend on the planet, but rather how much energy we invest in the time that we have. The premise of this audio program and of the training we do each year with thousands of clients is simple enough. Performance, health, and happiness are grounded in the skillful management of energy. There are undeniably bad bosses, toxic work environments, difficult relationships, and real-life crises. Nonetheless, we have far more control over our energy than we ordinarily realize. The number of hours in a day is fixed, but the quantity and quality of energy available to us is not. It is our most precious resource. The more we take responsibility for the energy we bring to the world, the more empowered and productive we become. The more we blame others or external circumstances, the more negative and compromised our energy is likely to be. If you could wake up tomorrow with significantly more positive, focused energy to invest at work and with your family, how significantly would that change your life for the better? As a leader and a manager, how valuable would it be to bring more positive energy and passion to the workplace? If those you lead could call on more positive energy, how would it affect their relationships with one another and the quality of service that they deliver to customers and clients? Leaders are the stewards of organizational energy in companies, organizations, and even in families. They inspire or demoralize others first by how effectively they manage their own energy, and next by how well they mobilize, focus, invest, and renew the collective energy of those they lead. The skillful management of energy, individually and organizationally, makes possible something that we call full engagement. To be fully engaged, we must be physically energized, emotionally connected, mentally focused, and spiritually aligned with a purpose beyond our immediate self-interest. Full engagement begins with feeling eager to get to work in the morning, equally happy to return home in the evening, and capable of setting clear boundaries between the two. It means being able to immerse yourself in the mission you are on, whether that is grappling with a creative challenge at work, managing a group of people on a project, spending time with loved ones, or simply having fun. Full engagement implies a fundamental shift in the way we live our lives. Less than 30% of American workers are fully engaged at work, according to data collected by the Gallup Organization in early 2001. Some 55% are not engaged, and another 19% are actively disengaged, meaning not just that they are unhappy at work, but that they regularly share those feelings with colleagues. The costs of a disengaged workforce run into the trillions of dollars. Worse yet, the longer employees stay with organizations, the less engaged they become. Gallup found that after 6 months on the job, only 38% of employees remain engaged. After 3 years, the figure drops to 22%. Think about your own life. How fully engaged are you at work? What about your colleagues or the people who work for you? During the past decade, we have grown increasingly disturbed by the myriad ways in which our clients squander and misuse their energy. These include everything from poor eating habits and failure to seek regular recovery and renewal, to negativity and poor focus. The lessons we seek to impart in this program have proved to be profoundly useful in managing our own lives and in leading our own organization. When we follow the energy management principles and the change process that we share in this program, we find that we're far more effective, both personally and professionally, in our own actions and in our relationships. When we fall short, We see the costs immediately in our performance and in our impact on others. The same is true of tens of thousands of clients with whom we have worked. Learning to manage energy more efficiently and intelligently has a unique transformative power, both individually and organizationally.
We first learned about the importance of energy in the living laboratory of professional sports. For 30 years, our organization has worked with world-class athletes, defining precisely what it takes to perform consistently at the highest levels under intense competitive pressures. Our initial clients were tennis players. Over 80 of the world's best players have been through our laboratory, among them Pete Sampras, Jim Courier, Arantxa Sánchez Vicario, Tom and Tim Gullickson, Sergi Bruguera, Gabriella Sabatini, and Monica Seles. These players typically came to us when they were struggling, and our interventions have often produced dramatic turnarounds. Here's what happened after we worked with them. Arantxa Sánchez Vicario won the U.S. Open for the first time and became the top-ranked player in the world in both singles and doubles, and Sabatini won her first and only U.S. Open title. Bruguera went from number 79 in the world to top 10 and won two French Open titles. We went on to train a broad range of professional athletes, among them golfers Marco Mera and Ernie Els, hockey players Eric Lindros and Mike Richter, boxer Ray Boom Boom Mancini, basketball players Nick Anderson and Grant Hill, and speed skater Dan Jansen, who won his only Olympic gold medal following two intensive years of training with us. What makes our intervention with athletes unique is that we spend no time focusing on their technical or tactical skills. Conventional wisdom holds that if you can find talented people and equip them with the right skills for the challenge at hand, they will perform at their best. In our experience, that often isn't so. Energy is the X factor that makes it possible to fully ignite talent and skill. We never addressed how Monica Seles hit her serves, or how Marco Mera drove the ball, or how Grant Hill shot his free throws. All of these athletes were extraordinarily gifted and accomplished when they came to us. We focused instead on helping them to manage their energy more effectively in the service of whatever mission they were on. Athletes turned out to be a demanding experimental group. They aren't satisfied with inspirational messages or clever theories about performance. They seek measurable, enduring results. They care about batting averages, free throw shooting percentages, tournament victories, and year-end rankings. They want to be able to sink the putt on the 18th hole in the final round, hit the free throw when the game is on the line, catch the pass in a crowd with a minute to go on the clock. Anything else is just talk. If we couldn't deliver results for athletes, we didn't last very long in their lives. We learned to be accountable to the numbers. As word spread about our success in sports, we received numerous requests to export our model into other high-performance venues. We began working with FBI hostage rescue teams, U.S. Marshals, and critical care workers in hospitals. Today, the bulk of our work is in business, with executives and entrepreneurs, managers and salespeople, and more recently with teachers and clergy, lawyers and medical students. Our corporate clients include Fortune 500 companies such as Estee Lauder, Solomon Smith Barney, Pfizer, Merrill Lynch, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and the Hyatt Corporation. Along the way, we discovered something completely unexpected. The demands that most people face in their everyday work environments dwarf those of any professional athletes we have ever trained. How is that possible? It's not as anomalous as it seems. Professional athletes typically spend about 90% of their time training in order to be able to perform 10% of the time. Their entire lives are designed around expanding, sustaining, and renewing the energy they need to compete for short, focused periods of time. At a practical level, they build very precise routines for managing energy in all spheres of their lives, eating, sleeping, working out, and resting, summoning the appropriate emotions, mentally preparing and staying focused, and connecting regularly to the mission they have set for themselves. Although most of us spend little or no time systematically training in any of these dimensions, we are expected to perform at our best for 8, 10, and even 12 hours a day. Most professional athletes also enjoy an off-season of 4 to 5 months a year. After competing under extraordinary pressure for several months, a long off-season gives athletes the critical time they need for rest and healing, renewal and growth. By contrast, your off-season likely amounts to a few weeks of vacation a year. And even then, you probably aren't solely resting and recovering. More likely, you are spending at least some of your vacation time answering email, checking your voicemail, and ruminating about your work. Finally, professional athletes have an average career span of 5 to 7 years. If they've handled their finances reasonably well, they are often set for life. Few of them are under pressure to run out and get another job. By contrast, you can probably expect to work for 40 to 50 years without any significant breaks. Given these stark facts, what makes it possible to keep performing at your best without sacrificing your health, your happiness, and your passion for life? You must become a corporate athlete. The challenge of great performance is to manage your energy more effectively in all dimensions to achieve your goals. 4 key energy management principles drive this process. They lie at the heart of the change process that we will describe in the minutes ahead. They are critical for building the capacity to live a productive, fully engaged life.
Principle 1. Full engagement requires drawing on 4 separate but related sources of energy: physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. Human beings are complex energy systems, and full engagement is not simply one-dimensional. The energy that pulses through us is physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. All 4 dynamics are critical, none is sufficient by itself, and each profoundly influences the others. To perform at our best, we must skillfully manage each of these interconnected dimensions of energy. Subtract any one from the equation, and our capacity to fully ignite our talent and skill is diminished, much the way that an engine sputters when one of its cylinders misfires. The importance of full engagement is most vivid in situations where the consequences of disengagement are profound. Imagine for a moment that you're facing open-heart surgery. How would you feel if the surgeon entered the operating room feeling angry, frustrated, or anxious? How about overworked, exhausted, or depressed? What if he was just disengaged, laid back, and slightly spacey? Obviously, you want your surgeon energized, confident, and upbeat. Imagine that every time you yelled at someone in frustration, or did sloppy work on a project, or failed to focus your attention fully on the task at hand, you put someone's life at risk. Very quickly, you would become less negative, reckless, and sloppy in the way that you manage your energy. We hold ourselves accountable for the ways that we manage our time, and for that matter, our money. We must learn to hold ourselves at least equally accountable for how we manage our energy physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually.
Principle 2. Because energy capacity diminishes, both with overuse and with underuse, we must balance energy expenditure with intermittent energy renewal. We rarely consider how much energy we are spending because we take it for granted that the energy available to us is limitless. In fact, increased demand progressively depletes our energy reserves, especially in the absence of any effort to reverse the progressive loss of capacity that occurs with age. By training in all dimensions, we can dramatically slow our decline physically and mentally, and we can actually deepen our emotional and spiritual capacity until the very end of our lives. By contrast, when we live highly linear lives, spending far more energy than we recover or recovering more than we spend, the eventual consequence is that we break down, burn out, atrophy, lose our passion, get sick, and even die prematurely. Sadly, the need for recovery is often viewed as evidence of weakness, rather than as an integral aspect of sustained performance. The result is that we give almost no attention to renewing and expanding our energy reserves individually or organizationally. To maintain a powerful pulse in our lives, we must learn how to rhythmically spend and renew energy. The richest, happiest, and most productive lives are characterized by the ability to fully engage in the challenge at hand, but also to disengage periodically and seek renewal. Instead, many of us live our lives as if we are running in an endless marathon, pushing ourselves far beyond healthy levels of exertion. We become flatliners mentally and emotionally by relentlessly spending energy without sufficient recovery. We become flatliners physically and spiritually by not expending enough energy. Either way, we slowly but inexorably wear down. Think for a moment about the look of many long-distance runners, gaunt, sallow, slightly sunken, and emotionally flat. Now visualize a sprinter such as Marion Jones or Michael Johnson. Sprinters typically look powerful, bursting with energy and eager to push themselves to their limits. The explanation is simple. No matter how intense the demand they face, the finish line is clearly visible 100 or 200 meters down the track. We too must learn to live our lives as a series of sprints, fully engaging for periods of time, and then fully disengaging and seeking renewal before jumping back into the fray to face whatever challenges confront us.
Principle 3. To build capacity, we must push beyond our normal limits, training in the same systematic way that elite athletes do. Stress is not the enemy in our lives. Paradoxically, it's the key to growth. In order to build strength in a muscle, we must systematically stress it, expending energy beyond normal limits. Doing so literally causes microscopic tears in the muscle fibers. At the end of a training session, functional capacity is diminished. But give that muscle 24 to 48 hours to recover, and it grows stronger and better able to handle the next stimulus. While this training phenomenon has been applied largely to building physical strength, it is just as relevant to building muscles in every dimension of our lives, from empathy and patience, to focus and creativity, to integrity and commitment. What applies to the body applies equally to the other dimensions of our lives. This insight both simplifies and revolutionizes the way we approach the barriers that stand in our way. We build emotional, mental, and spiritual capacity in precisely the same way that we build physical capacity. We grow at all levels by expending energy beyond our ordinary limits and then recovering. Expose a muscle to ordinary demand and it won't grow. With age, it will actually lose strength. The limiting factor in building any muscle is that many of us back off at the slightest hint of discomfort. To meet the increased demand in our lives, we must learn to systematically build and strengthen muscles wherever our capacity is insufficient. Any form of stress that prompts discomfort has the potential to expand our capacity, physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, so long as it is followed by adequate recovery. As Nietzsche put it, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. Because the demands on corporate athletes are greater and more enduring than those on professional athletes, it is even more critical that they learn to train in this systematic way.
Principle number 4. Positive energy rituals, highly specific routines for managing energy, are the key to full engagement and sustained high performance. Change is difficult. We are creatures of habit. Most of what we do is automatic and unconscious. What we did yesterday is what we are likely to do today. The problem with most efforts at change is that conscious effort can't be sustained over the long haul. Will and discipline are far more limited resources than most of us realize. If you have to think about something each time you do it, the likelihood is that you won't keep doing it for very long. The status quo has a magnetic pull on us. A positive ritual is a behavior that becomes automatic over time, fueled by some deeply held value. We use the word ritual purposefully to emphasize the notion of a carefully defined, highly structured behavior. In contrast to will and discipline, which require pushing yourself to a particular behavior, a ritual pulls at you. Think of something as simple as brushing your teeth. It is not something that you ordinarily have to remind yourself to do. Brushing your teeth is something to which you feel consistently drawn, compelled by its clear health value. You do it largely on automatic pilot, without much conscious effort or intention. The power of rituals is that they ensure that we use as little conscious energy as possible where it is not absolutely necessary, leaving us free to strategically focus the energy available to us in creative, enriching ways. Look at any part of your life in which you're consistently effective, and you'll find that certain habits help make that possible. If you eat in a healthy way, it is probably because you have built routines around the food you buy and what you are willing to order at restaurants. If you are fit, it is probably because you have regular days and times for working out. If you are successful in a sales job, you probably have a ritual of mental preparation for calls and ways that you talk to yourself to stay positive in the face of rejection. If you manage others effectively, you are likely to have a style of giving feedback that leaves people feeling challenged rather than threatened. If you are closely connected to your spouse and to your children, you probably have rituals around spending time with them. If you sustain high positive energy despite an extremely demanding job, you almost certainly have predictable ways of ensuring that you get intermittent recovery. Creating positive rituals is the most powerful means we have found to effectively manage energy in the service of full engagement.
Making all of this happen is another story. How can we build and sustain the multidimensional energy that we need, particularly as the demands in our lives intensify and our capacity diminishes inexorably with age? Making changes that endure, we have found, is a three-step process that we call purpose, truth, action. All three are necessary, and none is sufficient by itself. The first step in our change process is to define purpose. In the face of our habitual behaviors and our instinct to preserve the status quo, we need inspiration to make changes in our lives. Our first challenge is to answer the question, how should I spend my energy in a way that is consistent with my deepest values? The consequence of living our lives at warp speed is that we rarely take the time to reflect on what we value most deeply or to keep those priorities front and center. Most of us spend more time reacting to immediate crises and responding to the expectations of others than we do making considered choices guided by a clear sense of what matters most. In the purpose stage, our goal is to help clients to surface and to articulate the most important values in their lives and to define a vision for themselves, both personally and professionally. Connecting to a deep set of values and creating a compelling vision fuels a uniquely high-octane source of energy for change. It also serves as a compass for navigating the storms that inevitably arise in our lives. It is impossible to chart a course of change until you are able to look honestly at who you are today. In the next stage of our process, Face the Truth, the first question we ask clients is, how are you spending your energy now? Facing the Truth begins with gathering credible data. When clients come to us, we take them through a variety of physical tests, carefully assess their diets, and give them a detailed questionnaire designed to measure precisely how they're managing their energy physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. We also have 5 of their closest colleagues fill out a similar questionnaire. All of this data gives us a clear picture of their current energy capacity and of the obstacles that stand in the way of full engagement. To launch this process for yourself, we encourage you to take a first step. Log on to our powerofullengagement.com website and take a brief version of our full engagement inventory. That's powerofullengagement.com, no spaces. The scores that you receive will provide baseline data about your primary performance barriers. For a more detailed analysis of how you are managing your energy, you can arrange to take our complete full engagement inventory online. Facing the Truth requires gathering as much comprehensive and objective data as is possible. The third step in your change process is to take action to close the gap between who you are and who you want to be, between how you manage your energy now and how you want to manage your energy to achieve whatever mission you're on. This step involves building a personal development plan grounded in positive energy rituals. Some of our existing habits serve us well, but others are more expedient. They help us get through the day, but they take a long-term toll on our performance, health, and happiness. Examples include relying on junk food for bursts of energy, smoking or drinking to manage anxiety, furiously multitasking to meet demands, setting aside more challenging long-term projects in favor of what feels immediately pressing and easier to accomplish, and devoting little energy to personal relationships. The costs of these choices and many others only show up over time. But just as negative habits and routines in our lives can be undermining and destructive, so positive ones can be uplifting and revitalizing. It is possible to build and sustain energy in all dimensions of our lives, rather than watching passively as our capacity slowly diminishes with age. Building rituals requires defining very precise behaviors and performing them at very specific times, motivated by deeply held values. As Aristotle put it, we are what we repeatedly do. Or as the Dalai Lama said more recently, there isn't anything that isn't made easier through constant familiarity and training. Through training, we can change. We can transform ourselves. The story of Roger B., one of our clients, vividly demonstrates how the casual choices that we make each day, often without thinking much about them, can slowly lead to compromised energy, diminished performance, and a progressively disengaged life. When he came to work with us at our training facility in Orlando, Florida, Roger B. seemed to be living a quintessentially successful life. At 42, he was a sales manager for a large software company. He had a six-figure salary, responsibility over four Western states, and 18 months earlier, he'd been named a vice president, his fourth promotion in less than 6 years. He met his wife, Rachel, 39, in college, and they began dating in their mid-20s. Married for 15 years, they had two children, 9-year-old Alyssa and 7-year-old Isabel, and Rachel had her own busy career as a school psychologist. They lived in a suburb of Phoenix on a cul-de-sac with a half-dozen other young families, in a house that they had helped to design themselves. Between their demanding careers and the challenge of raising two kids who had busy schedules of their own, life was very full. But it was also a life they'd worked very hard to achieve. At first blush, it was difficult to see much of a problem. Nonetheless, when Roger came to see us, we knew that his boss was increasingly unhappy with Roger's performance at work. We considered him a rising star for many years, his boss told us. I really don't know what happened. 2 years ago, we gave him a big promotion into an important leadership position, and since then he's gone from an A-level performer to a C-plus at best. It's affecting his whole sales force. I'm disappointed and I'm frustrated. I haven't completely given up hope, but if something doesn't change soon, he's not going to make it. Nothing would make me happier than if you could get him back on track. He's a good man with a lot of talent. I would hate to have to let him go. A critical part of our process involves taking a closer look at what's going on beneath the surface of our clients' lives. Facing the truth begins with our full engagement inventory, a highly detailed questionnaire designed to surface people's behavioral patterns and to measure how effectively they're spending and recovering energy in all dimensions of their lives. In addition, Roger filled out a brief medical history and a comprehensive nutritional profile, detailing precisely what he had eaten on three designated days. When he got to our facility, we put him through a number of physical tests, which included assessing his cardiovascular capacity, strength, flexibility, body fat percentage, and blood chemistry markers such as his cholesterol level. Roger's data indicated five primary performance barriers: low energy, impatience, negativity, lack of depth in relationships, and lack of passion. While he found it disturbing to receive this feedback from colleagues, his self-assessment was only slightly more positive. All performance barriers, we have found, are attributable to poor energy management, either in the form of insufficient energy renewal, insufficient energy capacity, or more typically, both. In addition, any given performance barrier is almost always influenced by multidimensional factors. In Roger's case, the most obvious contributing factor in all of his performance barriers was the way that he managed his physical energy. He played basketball and tennis and prided himself on being in excellent shape. On his medical form, he rated himself as 5 to 10 pounds overweight, but in answer to another question, he acknowledged that he had gained 23 pounds since graduating from high school. His body fat percentage was 27, average for the male clients that we see, but more than 25% over the acceptable limit for a man his age. His belly now peeked out over his belt, a sign of middle age that he had always sworn would never happen to him. At his latest checkup, Roger's blood pressure had been measured at 150 over 90, just on the cusp of hypertensive. He acknowledged that his physician had urged him to make some changes in his diet and to get more exercise. His total cholesterol level was 235, significantly above the ideal level. Roger had quit smoking a decade earlier, although he confessed that he still had an occasional cigarette when he felt specially stressed. "I don't consider that smoking," he said, "and I don't want to talk about it." Roger's eating habits went a long way toward explaining his weight gain and his problems with low energy. "Most days he skipped breakfast altogether. I'm always trying to lose weight," he told us. But he frequently broke down at mid-morning and ordered a blueberry muffin with his second cup of coffee. When he was in the office, he usually consumed lunch at his desk, and while he tried hard to limit himself to a sandwich and a salad, he frequently also had a large bowl of frozen yogurt for dessert. When he was traveling, he often just grabbed a hamburger and fries for lunch, or a couple of slices of pizza that he ate on the run. Around 4 p.m. on most days, his energy flagging badly, Roger often treated himself to a handful of cookies, which always seemed to be around the office. Over the course of a day, his energy spiked and crashed, depending on how long he'd gone without eating and what sort of sugary snacks he ate. The energy crashes strongly influenced both his level of irritability and his capacity for focus. Dinner was Roger's biggest meal and the primary factor in his weight gain. By the time that he sat down at 7:30 or 8 p.m., he was usually famished and ready for something substantial. A big bowl of pasta or a generous portion of chicken or steak, potatoes, a well-dressed salad, and lots of bread. About half the time, he managed to resist eating another sugary snack before bed. Roger nearly always managed to resist exercise, which would have offset some of the effects of overeating, and also provided a powerful way to detoxify negative emotions and to renew mentally. His explanation was that he simply couldn't find the time or the energy to work out. He was on the road most mornings at 6:30. By the time he got home in the evenings, beat from an hour and 15-minute commute, the last thing he wanted to do was take a jog or jump on the stationary bike in his basement. Instead, it sat unused alongside other earlier inspirations, a rowing machine, a Nordic track, and a hulking pile of free weights. To unwind from the stresses of the day, Roger typically had a martini when he got home at night, and a glass or two of wine with dinner, which only made him more tired. Even so, he found it hard to get himself to bed at a reasonable hour, and when he finally turned out the light around 12:30 or 1 a.m., after taking one last check of his email, he often slept fitfully, and at most for 5 to 6 hours. At least once or twice a week, the struggle to fall asleep reached the point that he took a sleeping pill. On the nights he entertained clients, Roger acknowledged that he often had more to drink. Dinners started and ended later, and the wine usually flowed freely. Between a cocktail reception and a long dinner, it wasn't uncommon to consume 3 or 4 glasses of wine in the course of an evening. Not only did that add several hundred empty calories to Roger's diet, it also frequently left him feeling groggy the next morning. Without caffeine, Roger would have had a hard time getting through his days. He tried to limit himself to 2 cups of coffee in the morning, 3 on a day when he felt really exhausted. He had twice tried to quit coffee, but when he did, he got terrible headaches. By keeping a nutritional log before coming to visit us, Roger also discovered that he was adding to his caffeine intake by consuming 2 or 3 diet colas each afternoon. Cumulatively, Roger's choices took a severe toll not only on the quantity and quality of energy available to him, but also on his focus and his motivation. At the emotional level, Roger's primary performance barriers were impatience and negativity. He found this sobering. Just as he had grown up thinking of himself as an athlete, so Roger had always considered himself easygoing. In high school and in his fraternity at college, he was known as friendly and funny, the guy you could always count on for a good time. At the office in his early years, he was the person who made everyone laugh. Over time, however, his humor had acquired an edge. Where it had once been mostly gentle and self-deprecating, now it was often sarcastic and edgy. Low energy was plainly a factor since it made Roger more vulnerable to negative emotions. At the same time, there was little about his current life that made him feel positive. During Roger's first 7 years at the company, the pressures were high, but the opportunities were great. His boss was a nurturing man who mentored him, liked his ideas, gave him lots of freedom, and helped him to advance rapidly up the corporate ladder. His boss's positive energy made Roger feel better about himself. Now the company was experiencing a slowdown. Expenses were being cut, layoffs had begun, and everyone was expected to do more with less. His boss had been given broader responsibilities, Roger saw much less of him, and he couldn't help but feel that he had fallen out of favor. It affected not just his mood, but also his passion for his work, and ultimately his performance. Energy is highly infectious, and negativity feeds on itself. Leaders have a disproportionate impact on the energy of others. Roger's moods powerfully influence those who work for him, much as the feeling of being neglected by his own boss deeply affected Roger's energy. Relationships are one of the most powerful sources of emotional renewal. For years, Roger had thought of Rachel as both his lover and his best friend. Now, with so little time together, the feeling of romance and intimacy seemed like a distant memory, and sex had become much less frequent. Their relationship was increasingly transactional. Conversations focused largely on household logistics and negotiations. Who was going to pick up the dry cleaning or the takeout dinner? Which kid needed a ride to which after-school activity? They spent very little time talking with each other about what was really going on in their lives. Rachel had her own preoccupations. Her job as a psychologist covering several schools was demanding in itself. A year earlier, her father had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 77, and his deterioration was rapid. What little time Rachel previously had for herself, particularly for working out, which she craved as a way to keep her weight down and to relieve tension, was now gone. Instead, she spent much of her free time helping her mother with the increasingly demanding task of caring for her father. The pressure of her father's illness, added to the demands of being a mother and working at a full-time job, had plainly sapped her energy reserves. It also made her even less available to Roger. He understood the stresses that Rachel was under, but he couldn't help feeling a bit abandoned, much as he did by his boss. Meanwhile, Alyssa, 9, had begun having some problems in school. After testing, it turned out that she had some modest learning disabilities. She became convinced that she was stupid, and it was beginning to affect her schoolwork and her social life. Roger knew that Alyssa needed attention and reassurance, but often he just couldn't summon the energy to reach out to her in the evenings. Isabel, the 7-year-old, seemed to be doing fine, but Roger's fatigue also affected his relationship with her. When she sought him out to play cards or Monopoly with her, he often begged off or suggested that they watch television together instead. As for friendship, there just wasn't much time, given all the other demands in his life. The 3 friends that Roger did see regularly were his golfing buddies, and while he found the time they spent together relaxing, it wasn't especially satisfying. Competing noisily on the golf course and then smoking cigars and drinking beer in the clubhouse afterward felt more like fraternity life than real friendship. Rachel didn't have much use for the guys and resented the time that Roger spent playing golf. He was gone for 5 or 6 hours on Saturdays, and she complained that the time would be better spent with the kids or doing errands. Roger believed that he deserved at least 1 chunk of time for himself after his tiring weeks, but he worried guiltily that Rachel had a legitimate point. After all, she took no comparable time for herself. The irony was that even with the golf, his weekends at home rarely left him feeling restored or renewed. The way that Roger managed his energy physically and emotionally helped to account for his 3rd performance barrier, poor focus. Fatigue, unhappiness with his boss, frustration with Rachel, guilt about not spending more time with his children, and the increased demands of his new job all made it difficult for him to stay focused mentally at work. Managing his time, which had never been much of an issue when he worked primarily as a salesman, was significantly more difficult now that he was expected to supervise 40 people in 4 states. For the first time in his career, Roger found that he was distracted and inefficient. On a typical day in the office, Roger received between 50 and 75 emails and at least 2 dozen voicemails. Like nearly everyone he knew, Roger rarely left his work at the office. On his commute home at the end of the day, He usually spent his time on the cell phone, returning calls. He answered email in the evenings and on the weekends. During the family's first European vacation the previous summer, Roger had felt compelled to check his voicemail and his email every day. The prospect of returning home to 1,000 unread emails and 200 voicemails seemed worse, he told himself, than taking an hour out of each vacation day to stay current. The result was that Roger almost never disconnected completely from work. The truth was that Roger now spent so much of his life responding to external demands that he had lost touch with any sense of what he really wanted from life. When we asked what gave him the greatest sense of passion and meaning in his life, he came up empty. He didn't feel much passion at work, he admitted, even though his authority and his stature had increased. He didn't feel much at home, even though it was clear that he loved his wife and children and considered them his highest priorities. The powerful source of energy that can be derived from connecting to a clear sense of purpose simply wasn't available to Roger. Unmoored from deeply held values, he didn't have much motivation to take better care of himself physically, or to control his impatience, or even to prioritize his time and focus his attention. With so much to keep him busy, he spent very little energy reflecting on the choices that he had made. Thinking about his life only made him feel uncomfortable anyway, since nothing seemed likely to change. Roger had nearly everything that he once thought he wanted from life, but more often than not, what he felt was tired and frustrated, overworked and underappreciated. Above all, Roger told us, he felt like a victim of factors beyond his control. I'm a good guy, a decent guy, and I'm doing the best I can for my family. Sure, I'm struggling, but I'm just trying to meet my responsibilities. I've got house payments and car payments, and I'm trying to save for college for the kids. I'd love to stay in shape, but between my commute and the hours I put in, I just can't find the time. It's true I put on some weight, but when you live your life on the run, it's hard to eat healthy meals. Yeah, I eat snacks during the day, but how bad are a couple of cookies and an occasional bowl of frozen yogurt? A cigarette or two a day and a couple of drinks in the evening, they're just small pleasures that help take the edge off. It's not like I'm addicted. I probably do get frustrated and lose my temper more often than I should, but that's not who I really am. I'm not getting much support, and the cutbacks at the company aren't making things any easier. It's hard to be focused and excited when you're under so much pressure. I feel very guilty about not spending more time with my kids, and I definitely owe them more than I'm giving. Rachel is right that even when I'm there, I'm not really there. But then neither is she. I miss having time with my wife, and I do sometimes feel a little neglected. But then I realize she's got plenty on her plate, too. I definitely wish I felt better about my life, but I'm not sure what I should be doing differently. It could be a lot worse, I'll tell you that. Half of the people in my office are divorced. Last week, a 42-year-old guy down the hall dropped dead of a heart attack right at his desk. I just try to keep moving forward, put one foot in front of the other. This isn't exactly how I imagined things were going to be, but if there's a better way, I haven't figured it out.
Without being aware of it, Roger B. was living a highly linear life. By working long hours and rarely shutting down, even when he was home, he was relentlessly spending mental energy without getting much recovery. The concept of maximizing performance by alternating periods of activity with periods of rest was first advanced by Flavius Philostratus, who wrote training manuals for Greek athletes. Russian sports scientists resurrected the concept in the 1960s and began applying it with stunning success to their Olympic athletes. Today, work-rest ratios lie at the heart of periodization, a training method used by elite athletes throughout the world. The science of periodization has become more precise and more sophisticated over the years, but the basic concept hasn't changed since it was first introduced nearly 2,000 years ago. Following a period of activity, the body must replenish fundamental biochemical sources of energy. This is called compensation, and when it occurs, energy expended is recovered. Increase the intensity of the training or of the performance demand, and it is necessary to commensurately increase the amount of energy renewal. Fail to do so, and the athlete will experience a measurable deterioration in performance. Energy is simply the capacity to do work. Our most fundamental need as human beings is to spend and recover energy. We need energy to perform, and recovery is more than just the absence of work. It serves not just health and happiness, but also performance. Nearly every elite athlete we have worked with over the years has come to us with performance problems that could be traced to an imbalance between the expenditure and the recovery of energy. They were either overtraining or undertraining in one or more dimensions, physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually. Both overtraining and undertraining have performance consequences that include persistent injuries and sickness, anxiety, negativity, and anger, difficulty concentrating, and loss of passion. We achieved our breakthroughs with athletes by helping them to more skillfully manage energy, pushing themselves to systematically increase capacity in whatever dimension it was insufficient, and also to build in regular recovery as a part of their training regimens. Balancing stress and recovery is critical, not just in competitive sports, but also in managing energy in all facets of our lives. When we expend energy, we draw down our reservoir. When we recover energy, we fill it back up. Too much energy expenditure without sufficient recovery eventually leads to burnout and breakdown. Too much recovery without sufficient stress leads to atrophy and weakness. The same process occurs emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. Emotional depth and resilience depend on active engagement with others and with our own feelings. Mental acuity diminishes in the absence of ongoing intellectual challenge. Spiritual energy capacity depends on regularly revisiting our deepest values and holding ourselves accountable in our behavior. Full engagement requires cultivating a dynamic balance between the expenditure of energy and the renewal of energy in all dimensions. We call this rhythmic wave oscillation, and it represents the fundamental pulse of life. The more powerful our pulse, the more fully engaged we can be, and the same is true organizationally. To the degree that leaders and managers build cultures around continuous work, whether that means several-hour meetings or long days or the expectation that people will work in the evenings and on weekends, performance is necessarily compromised over time. Cultures that encourage people to seek intermittent renewal not only inspire greater commitment, but also more productivity. Instead, most of us tend to live far more linear lives. We assume that we can spend energy indefinitely in some dimensions, often the mental and emotional, and we can perform effectively without investing much energy at all in the others, most commonly the physical and the spiritual. We become flatliners. To live like a sprinter is to break life down into a series of manageable intervals consistent with our own physiological needs and with the periodic rhythms of nature. This insight first crystallized for me when I was working with world-class tennis players. As a performance psychologist, my goal was to understand the factors that set apart the greatest competitors in the world from the rest of the pack. I spent hundreds of hours watching players and studying tapes of their matches. To my growing frustration, I could detect almost no significant differences in their competitive habits during points. It was only when I began to notice what they did between points that I suddenly saw a difference. While most of them were not aware of it, the best players had each built almost exactly the same set of routines between points. These included the way they walked back to the baseline after a point, how they held their heads and their shoulders, where they focused their eyes, the pattern of their breathing, and even the way they talked to themselves. It dawned on me that these players were instinctively using the time between points to maximize their recovery. Many lower-ranked competitors, I began to see, had no recovery routines at all. When I hooked up the players to EKG telemetry, which allowed me to monitor their heart rates, I made another startling discovery. In the 16 to 20 seconds between points in a match, the heart rates of top competitors dropped as much as 20 beats. By building highly efficient and focused recovery routines, these players had found a way to derive extraordinary energy renewal in a very short period of time. Because lesser competitors had no comparable routines between points, their heart rates often remained at very high levels throughout their matches regardless of their level of fitness. The best competitors were using rituals to recover more efficiently and to better prepare for each upcoming point. In the language of sports, Roger was overtraining mentally and emotionally and undertraining physically and spiritually. Fatigue prompted anxiety, irritability, and self-doubt, and Roger had very few positive sources of emotional renewal, even from his primary relationships. Because he expended precious little energy in activity and exercise, he had progressively lost endurance, strength, and resilience. Because he had grown disconnected from deeply held values or a sense of purpose, the spiritual dimension represented another flat line in his life, a potential source of energy that he simply had not cultivated. Roger was not much different from many of us, in part because the choices he was making are so socially sanctioned. We live in a world that celebrates work and activity, ignores renewal and recovery, and fails to recognize that both are necessary for sustained high performance. At the most practical level, our capacity to be fully engaged depends on our ability to periodically disengage. For most of us, this requires an entirely new way of thinking about how to manage our energy. Many of us treat life as a marathon that doesn't end until it finally ends for good. Along the way, we learn strategies for conserving our limited resources. This may mean expending energy at a certain steady level at work, but rarely fully engaging or pushing very intensely on the job, and then having little energy left to invest at home. Or it may mean slowly disengaging in every sphere of life, as Roger had begun to do. It is not the intensity of energy expenditure that produces burnout, impaired performance, and physical breakdown, but rather the duration of expenditure without recovery. In Japan, the term karoshi can be translated literally as death from overwork, most commonly from heart attack and stroke. The first case of karoshi was reported in 1969. The Japanese Ministry of Labor began to publish statistics on the syndrome in 1987, and the National Defense Council for Victims of Karoshi was launched the following year. Some 10,000 deaths a year in Japan are now attributed to karoshi, and research shows that there are five key factors. Extremely long hours that interfere with normal recovery and rest patterns. Night work that interferes with normal recovery and rest patterns. Working without holidays or breaks. High-pressure work without breaks. And extremely demanding physical labor and continuously stressful work. What these five factors have in common is a pattern of chronic energy expenditure and an absence of intermittent recovery. The number of Japanese workers who put in more than 3,120 hours a year, an average of more than 60 hours a week, increased from 3 million, or 15% of the workforce, in 1975, to 7 million, or 24%, in 1988. One case study described a worker who died suddenly at the age of 45. It turned out that he had worked 13 consecutive days, including six successive night shifts. His job was assembling engine parts for Mazda Motor Company, and he worked on a line where the speed was 2 minutes per car. The methods devised to assure maximum efficiency were so unforgiving that workers had almost no time at all to recover. Under this production method, the researchers concluded, the worker resembles a mouse running helplessly in a rotating wheel in order to avoid electric shock. No comparable research on the health or consequences of overwork exists in the United States, but America is the only country in the world in which employees work more hours per week than the Japanese. Regularly renewing our energy ensures that we can sustain full engagement so long as demand remains constant. But what happens when increased demand overwhelms our capacity and even a full tank is not enough? The answer is paradoxical and precisely the opposite of what you've been told most of your life. To build capacity, we must systematically expose ourselves to more stress, followed by adequate recovery. Challenging a muscle past its current limits prompts a phenomenon known as supercompensation. Faced with a demand that exceeds the muscle's current capacity, the body responds by building more muscle fibers in anticipation of the next stimulus. The same is true, we have found, of muscles at all levels, emotional, mental, and spiritual. The catch is that we instinctively resist pushing beyond our current comfort zones. Homeostasis is a state of equilibrium, the biological maintenance of the